We told them our story. Or rather, I did. Meg sat at the edge of the pond and stared desolately into the water. Crest crawled into one of the niches and wrapped his ears around himself like a blanket, cradling my ukulele the same way Melly cradled baby Chuck. My voice broke several times as I described Jason's final battle. His death finally became real to me. I gave up any hope that I would wake from this nightmare. I expected Gleason Hedge to explode, to start swinging his bat at everything and everyone. But like Tristan McLean, he surprised me. The satyr became still and calm, his voice unnervingly even.
"I was the kid's protector," he said. "I should have been there."
Grover tried to console him, but Hedge raised a hand.
"Don't. Just don't."
He faced Melly.
"Piper's gonna need us."
The cloud nymph brushed away a tear. "Yes, of course." Olivera wrung her hands. "Should I go too? Maybe there's something I can do?" She looked at me suspiciously. "Did you try aloe vera on this Grace boy?" "I fear he is truly dead," I said. "Beyond even the powers of aloe." She looked unconvinced, but Melly squeezed her shoulder. "You're needed here, aloe. Heal Apollo and Meg. Gleason, get the diaper bag. I'll meet you at the car." With baby Chuck in her arms, she floated up and out of the cistern. Hedge snapped his fingers at me.
"Pinto keys."
I tossed them. "Please don't do anything rash. Caligula is..." "You can't." Hedge stopped me with a cold stare.
"I've got Piper to take care of. That's my priority. I'll leave the rash stuff to other people."
I heard the bitter accusation in his voice. Coming from Coach Hedge, that seemed deeply unfair, but I didn't have the heart to protest. Once the Hedge family was gone, Olivera fussed over Meg and me, smearing goo on our injuries. She tutted at the red plug in my chest and replaced it with a lovely green spike from her hair. The other dryads seemed at a loss for what to do or say. They stood around the pond, waiting and thinking. I suppose as plants they were comfortable with long silences. Grover Underwood sat down heavily next to Meg. He moved his fingers over the holes of his reed pipes.
"Losing a demigod."
He shook his head.
"That's the worst thing that can happen to a protector. Years ago, when I thought I'd lost Thalia Grace..."
He stopped himself, then slumped under the weight of despair.
"Oh, Thalia. When she hears about this..."
I didn't think I could feel any worse, but this idea sent a few more razor blades circulating through my chest. Thalia Grace had saved my life in Indianapolis. Her fury in combat had been rivaled only by the tenderness with which she spoke of her brother. I felt that I should be the one to break the news to her. On the other hand, I did not want to be in the same state when she heard it. I looked around at my dejected comrades. I remembered the Sybil's words in my dream. "It won't seem worth it to you. I'm not sure it is myself, but you must come. You must hold them together in their grief." Now I understood. I wished I didn't. How could I hold together a whole cistern full of prickly dryads when I couldn't even hold myself together? Nevertheless, I lifted the ancient pair of caligae we'd retrieved from the yachts. "At least we have these. Jason gave his life for us to have a chance at stopping Caligula's plans. Tomorrow, I'll wear these into the burning maze. I'll find a way to free the Oracle and stop the fires of Helios. I thought that was a pretty good pep talk, designed to restore confidence and reassure my friends. I left out the part about not having a clue how to accomplish any of it. Prickly Pear bristled, which she did with consummate skill. You're in no shape to do anything. Besides, Caligula will know what you're planning. He'll be waiting and ready this time.
She's right, Crest said from his niche.
The dryads frowned at him. Why is he even here? Choya demanded. Music lessons, I said. That earned me several dozen confused looks. Long story, I said. But Crest risked his life for us on the yachts. He saved Meg. We can trust him. I looked at the young Pandos and hoped my assessment was correct. Crest, is there anything you can tell us that might help? Crest wrinkled his fuzzy white nose, which did not at all make him look cute or make me want to cuddle him.
You cannot use the main entrance downtown. They will be waiting.
We got past you, Meg said.
Crest's giant ears turned pink around the edges.
That was different, he muttered.
My uncle was punishing me.
It was the lunch shift. No one ever attacks during the lunch shift.
He glared at me like I should have known this.
They will have more fighters now, and traps. The horse might even be there. He can move very fast. Just one phone call and he can arrive.
I remembered how quickly Incitatus had shown up at Macro's military madness, and how viciously he'd fought aboard the shoe ship. I was not anxious to face him again. Is there another way in? I asked. Something, I don't know, less dangerous and conveniently close to the Oracle's room? Crest hugged his ukulele. My ukulele, tighter.
There is one. I know it. Others don't.
Grover tilted his head. I have to say, that sounds a little too convenient. Crest made a sour face.
I like exploring. Nobody else does. Uncle Amax, he always said I was a daydreamer. But when you explore, you find things.
I couldn't argue with that. When I explored, I tended to find dangerous things that wanted to kill me. I doubted tomorrow would be any different. Could you lead us to this secret entrance? I asked. Crest nodded.
Then you will have a chance. You can sneak in. Get to the Oracle before the guards find you. Then you can come out and give me music lessons.
The dryads stared at me, their expressions unhelpfully blank. As if thinking, hey, we can't tell you how to die. That's your choice.
We'll do it, Meg decided for me.
Grover, you in? Grover sighed.
Of course.
But first, you two need sleep.
And healing,
Allo added. And enchiladas? I requested.
For breakfast?
On that point, we reached consensus. So, having enchiladas to look forward to, and also a likely fatal trip through the burning maze, I curled up in my sleeping bag and passed out. Chapter 36. A suspended fourth, the kind of chord you played just before suddenly. I woke covered in goo, and with aloe spikes, yet again, in my nostrils. On the bright side, my ribs no longer felt like they were filled with lava. My chest had healed, leaving only a puckered scar where I'd impaled myself. I'd never had a scar before. I wished I could see it as a badge of honor. Instead, I feared that now, whenever I looked down, I would remember the worst night of my life, At least I had slept deeply with no dreams. That aloe vera was good stuff. The sun blazed directly above. The cistern was empty except for me and Crest, who snored in his niche, clutching his ukulele teddy bear. Someone, probably hours ago, had left a breakfast enchilada plate with a big ombre soda next to my sleeping bag. The food had cooled to lukewarm. The ice in the soda had melted. I didn't care. I ate and drank ravenously. I was grateful for the hot salsa that cleared the smell of burning yachts out of my sinuses. Once I de-slimed myself and washed in the pond, I dressed in a fresh set of Macro's camouflage. Arctic white. Because there was such a demand for that in the Mojave Desert. I shouldered my quiver and bow. I tied Caligula's shoes to my belt. I considered trying to take the ukulele from Crest, but decided to let him keep it for now, since I did not want to get my hands bitten off. Finally, I climbed into the oppressive Palm Springs heat. Judging from the angle of the sun, it must have been about 3 in the afternoon. I wondered why Meg had let me sleep so late. I scanned the hillside and saw no one. For a guilty moment, I imagined that Meg and Grover had been unable to wake me and had gone by themselves to take care of the maze. "Darn it," I could say when they returned. "Sorry, guys, and I was all ready, too." But no, Caligula's sandals dangled from my belt. They wouldn't have left without those. I also doubted they'd have forgotten Crest, since he was the only one who knew the super-secret entrance to the maze. I caught a flicker of movement. 2 shadows moving behind the nearest greenhouse. I approached and heard voices in earnest conversation. Meg and Joshua. I wasn't sure whether to let them be or to march over and shout, "Meg, this is no time to flirt with your yucca boyfriend." Then I realized they were talking about climates and growing seasons. Ugh. I stepped into view and found them studying a line of 7 young saplings that had sprouted from the rocky soil, in the exact spots where Meg had planted her seeds only yesterday. Joshua spied me immediately, a sure sign that my Arctic camouflage was working. "Well, he's alive." He didn't sound particularly thrilled about this. "We were just discussing the new arrivals." Each sapling rose about 3 feet high, its branches white, its leaves pale green diamonds that looked much too delicate for the desert heat. "Those are ash trees," I said, dumbfounded. I knew a lot about ash trees. Well, more than I knew about most trees, anyway. Long ago, I had been called Apollo Melii, Apollo of the ash trees, because of a sacred grove I owned in... Oh, where was it? Back then, I had so many vacation properties, I couldn't keep them all straight. My mind began to whirl. The word Melii meant something besides just ash trees. It had special significance. Despite being planted in a completely hostile climate, these young plants radiated strength and energy even I could sense. They'd grown overnight into healthy saplings. I wondered what they might look like tomorrow. Melii. I turned the word over in my mind. What had Caligula said? Bloodborne. Silver wives. Meg frowned. She looked much better this morning, back in her stoplight-colored clothes that had been miraculously patched and laundered. I suspected the dryads, who were great with fabrics. Her cat-eye glasses had been repaired with blue electrical tape. The scars on her arms and face had faded into faint white streaks, like meteor trails across the sky. "I still don't get it," she said. "Ash trees don't grow in the desert. Why was my dad experimenting with ash?" "The Melii," I said. Joshua's eyes glittered. That was my thought, too.
The who?
Meg asked. I believe, I said, that your father was doing more than simply researching a new hardy plant strain. He was trying to recreate, or rather reincarnate, an ancient species of dryad. Was it my imagination, or did the young trees rustle? I restrained the urge to step back and run away. They were only saplings, I reminded myself. Nice, harmless baby plants that did not have any intention of murdering me. Joshua knelt. In his khaki safari clothes, with his tousled gray-green hair, he looked like a wild animal expert who was about to point out some deadly species of scorpion for the TV audience. Instead, he touched the branches of the nearest sapling, then quickly removed his hand. Could it be? He mused. They're not conscious yet, but the power I sense. Meg crossed her arms and pouted.
Well, I wouldn't have planted them here if I'd known they were important ash trees or whatever. Nobody told me.
Joshua gave her a dry smile. Meg McCaffrey, if these are the Melii, they will survive even in this harsh climate. They were the very first dryads. Seven sisters, born when the blood of the murdered Uranos fell upon the soil of Gia. They were created at the same time as the Furies, and with the same great strength. I shuddered. I did not like the Furies. They were ugly, ill-tempered, and had bad taste in music. The Bloodborne, I said. That's what Caligula called them. And the Silver Wives. Joshua nodded. According to legend, the Melii married humans who lived during the Silver Age and gave birth to the race of the Bronze Age. But we all make mistakes. I studied the saplings. They didn't look much like the mothers of Bronze Age humanity. They didn't look like the Furies either. Even for a skilled botanist like Dr. McCaffrey, I said, even with the blessing of Demeter, is reincarnating such powerful beings possible? Joshua swayed pensively. Who can say? It seems the family of Plymnaeus was pursuing this goal for millennia. No one would be better suited. Dr. McCaffrey perfected the seeds. His daughter planted them. Meg blushed.
I don't know. Whatever. Seems weird.
Joshua regarded the young ash trees. We will have to wait and see. But imagine seven primordial dryads, beings of great power, bent on the preservation of nature and the destruction of any who would threaten it. His expression turned unusually warlike for a flowering plant. Surely Caligula would see that as a major threat. I couldn't argue. Enough of a threat to burn down a botanist's house and send him and his daughter straight into the arms of Nero? Probably. Joshua rose. Well, I must go dormant. Even for me, the daylight hours are taxing. We will keep an eye on our seven new friends. Good luck on your quest. He burst into a cloud of yucca fiber. Meg looked disgruntled. Probably because I had interrupted their flirty talk about climate zones.
Ash trees, she grumbled. And I planted them in the desert.
You planted them where they needed to be, I said. If these truly are the Melii, I shook my head in amazement. They responded to you, Meg. You brought back a life force that has been absent for millennia. That is awe-inspiring. She looked over.
Are you making fun of me?
No, I assured her. You are your mother's child, Meg McCaffrey. You are quite impressive.
Huh.
I understood her skepticism. Demeter was rarely described as impressive. Too often, the goddess got ridiculed for not being interesting or powerful enough. Like plants, Demeter worked slowly and quietly. Her designs grew over the course of centuries, but when those designs came to fruition, bad fruit pun, sorry, they could be extraordinary. Like Meg McCaffrey.
"Go wake up, Crest," Meg told me. "I'll meet you down at the road. Grover's getting us a car."
Grover was almost as good as Piper McLean at procuring luxury vehicles. He had found us a red Mercedes XLS, which I normally would not have complained about, except it was the exact same make and model that Meg and I had driven from Indianapolis to the Cave of Trophonius. I'd like to tell you I didn't believe in bad omens, but since I was the god of omens, at least Grover agreed to drive. The winds had shifted south, filling the Morongo Valley with wildfire smoke and clogging traffic even more than usual. The afternoon sun filtered through the red sky like a baleful eye. I feared the sun might look that hostile for the rest of eternity if Caligula became the new solar god. But no, I couldn't think like that. If Caligula came into possession of the sun chariot, there was no telling what horrible things he would do to trick out his new ride. Sequencers, undercarriage lighting, a horn that played the riff from Lowrider. Some things could not be tolerated. I sat in the back seat with Crest and did my best to teach him basic ukulele chords. He was a quick learner, despite the size of his hands, but he grew impatient with the major chords and wanted to learn more exotic combinations.
"Show me the suspended fourth again," he said. "I like that."
Of course he would like the most unresolved chords.
"We should buy you a large guitar," I urged once more. "Or even a lute."
"You play ukulele," he said. "I will play ukulele."
Why did I always attract such stubborn companions? Was it my winning, easygoing personality? I didn't know. When Crest concentrated, his expression reminded me strangely of Meg's. Such a young face, yet so intent and serious, as if the fate of the world depended on this chord being played correctly, this packet of seeds being planted, this bag of rotten produce being thrown into the face of this particular street thug. Why that similarity should make me fond of Crest, I wasn't sure. But it struck me how much he had lost since yesterday. His job, his uncle, almost his life, and how much he had risked coming with us. "I never said how sorry I was," I ventured. "About your uncle, Amex?" Crest sniffed the ukulele fretboard.
"Why would you be sorry? Why would I?"
It's just, you know, an expression of courtesy. When you kill someone's relatives."
"I never liked him," Crest said. "My mother sent me to him. Said he would make me a real Pandos warrior."
He strummed his chord, but got a diminished seventh by mistake. He looked pleased with himself.
"I do not want to be a warrior."
"What is your job?"
Well, I'm the god of music."
"Then that is what I shall be, a god of music."
Meg glanced back and smirked. I tried to give Crest an encouraging smile, but I hoped he would not ask to flay me alive and consume my essence. I already had a waiting list for that.
"Well, let's master these chords first, shall we?"
We traced our way north of L.A., through San Bernardino, then Pasadena. I found myself gazing up at the hills where we'd visited the Edgerton School. I wondered what the faculty would do when they found Jason Grace missing, and when they discovered that their school van had been commandeered and abandoned at the Santa Barbara waterfront. I thought of Jason's diorama of Temple Hill on his desk. the sketchbooks that waited on his shelf.
It seemed unlikely I would live long enough to keep my promise to him, to bring his plans safely to the two camps.
The thought of failing him yet again hurt my heart, even worse than Crest's attempt at a G-flat minor six. Finally, Crest directed us south on Interstate 5, toward the city. We took the Crystal Springs Drive exit and plunged into Griffith Park with its winding roads, rolling golf courses, and thick groves of eucalyptus.
"Farther," Crest said. "The second right. Up that hill."
He guided us onto a gravel service road, not designed for a Mercedes XLS.
"It's up there." Crest pointed into the woods. "We must walk."
Grover pulled over next to a stand of yuccas, who, for all I knew, were friends of his. He checked out the trailhead, where a small sign read, "Old Los Angeles Zoo."
"I know this place."
Grover's goatee quivered.
"I hate this place. Why would you bring us here?"
"Told you,"
Crest said. "Maze entrance."
"But," Grover gulped, no doubt weighing his natural aversion to places that caged animals against his desire to destroy the burning maze.
"All right."
Meg seemed happy enough, all things considered. She breathed in the what passed in L.A. for fresh air, and even did a few tentative cartwheels as we made our way up the trail. We climbed to the top of the ridge. Below us spread the ruins of a zoo. Overgrown sidewalks, crumbling cement walls, rusty cages, and man-made caves filled with debris. Grover hugged himself, shivering despite the heat.
"The humans abandoned this place decades ago when they built their new zoo. I can still feel the emotions of the animals that were kept here. Their sadness. It's horrible."
"Down here."
Crest spread his ears and sailed over the ruins, landing in a deep grotto. Not having flight-worthy ears, the rest of us had to pick and climb our way through the tangled terrain. At last we joined Crest at the bottom of a grimy cement bowl, covered with dried leaves and litter.
"A bear pit?"
Grover turned pale.
"Ugh, poor bears."
Crest pressed his eight-fingered hands against the back wall of the enclosure. He scowled.
"This is not right. It should be here."
My spirit sank to a new low.
"You mean your secret entrance is gone?"
Crest hissed in frustration.
"I should not have mentioned this place to Screamer.
Amex must have heard us talking.
He sealed it somehow."
I was tempted to point out that it was never a good idea to share your secrets with someone named Screamer, but Crest looked like he felt bad enough already.
"What now?"
Meg asked. "Use the downtown exit?"
"Too dangerous," Crest said. "There must be a way to open this."
Grover was so twitchy I wondered if he had a squirrel in his pants. He looked like he wanted very much to give up and run from this zoo as fast as possible. Instead, he sighed.
"What did the prophecy say about your cloven guide?"
"That you alone knew the way," I recalled.
"But you already served that purpose getting us to Palm Springs."
Reluctantly, Grover pulled out his pipes.
"I guess I'm not done yet."
"A song of opening?" I asked. "Like Hedge used in Macro's store?" Grover nodded.
"I haven't tried this in a while.
Last time, I opened a path from Central Park into the underworld."
"Just get us into the maze, please," I advised.
"Not the underworld." He raised his pipes and trilled Rush's Tom Sawyer. Crest looked entranced. Meg covered her ears. The cement wall shook. It cracked down the middle, revealing a steep set of rough-hewn stairs leading down into the dark. Perfect, Grover grumbled. I hate the underground almost as much as I hate zoos. Meg summoned her blades. She marched inside. After a deep breath, Grover followed. I turned to Crest. Are you coming with us? He shook his head. I told you, I'm no fighter. I will watch the exit and practice my chords.
But I might need the yucca.
I will practice my chords, he insisted, and began strumming a suspended fourth. I followed my friends into the dark, that chord still playing behind me. Exactly the sort of tense background music one might expect just before a dramatic, blood-curdling fight. Sometimes I really hated suspended fourths. Chapter 37. Want to play a game? It's easy. You take a guess, then you burn to death. This part of the maze had no elevators, wandering government employees, or signs reminding us to honk before turning corners. We reached the bottom of the stairs and found a vertical shaft in the floor. Grover, being part goat, had no difficulty climbing down. After he called up that no monsters or fallen bears were waiting for us, Meg grew a thick swath of wisteria down the side of the pit, which allowed us some handholds, and also smelled lovely. We dropped into a small square chamber with four tunnels radiating outward, one from each wall. The air was hot and dry, as if the fires of Helios had recently swept through. Sweat beaded on my skin. In my quiver, arrow shafts creaked and fletching hissed. Grover peered forlornly at the tiny bit of sunlight seeping down from above. We'll get back to the upper world, I promised him. I was just wondering if Piper got my message. Meg looked at him over her blue-taped glasses.
What message?
I ran into a cloud nymph when I was picking up the Mercedes, he said, as if running into cloud nymphs often happened when he was borrowing automobiles. I asked her to take a message to Melly, tell her what we were up to, assuming, you know, the nymph makes it there safely. I considered this, wondering why Grover hadn't mentioned it earlier. Were you hoping Piper might meet us here? Not really. His expression said, yes, please, gods, we could use the help. I just thought she should know what we were doing in case... His expression said, in case we combust into flames and are never heard from again. I disliked Grover's expressions.
Time for the shoes, Meg said.
I realized she was looking at me.
What? The shoes.
She pointed at the sandals hanging from my belt. Oh, right. I tugged them from my belt. I don't suppose, either of you want to try them on?
Nuh-uh, said Meg.
Grover shuddered. I've had bad experiences with enchanted footwear. I was not excited to wear an evil emperor's sandals. I feared they might turn me into a power-hungry maniac. Also, they didn't go with my Arctic camouflage. Nevertheless, I sat on the floor and laced up the Caligae. It made me appreciate just how much more of the world the Roman Empire might have conquered if they'd had access to Velcro straps. I stood up and tried a few steps. The sandals dug into my ankles and pinched at the sides. In the plus column, I felt no more sociopathic than usual. Hopefully I had not been infected with Caligulitis. Okay, I said. Shoes, lead us to the Erythrian Sibyl. The shoes did nothing. I thrust a toe in one direction, then another, wondering if they needed a kickstart. I checked the soles for buttons or battery compartments. Nothing. What do we do now? I asked no one in particular. The chamber brightened with a faint gold light, as if someone had turned up a dimmer switch.
Guys?
Grover pointed at our feet. On the rough cement floor, the faint gold outline of a 5-foot square had appeared. If it had been a trap door, we would have all dropped straight through. Identical connected squares branched off down each of the corridors like the spaces of a board game. The trails were not of equal length. One extended only 3 spaces into the hallway, another was 5 spaces long, another was 7, another 6. Against the chamber wall on my right, a glowing golden inscription appeared in ancient Greek. Python Slayer, golden lyred, armed with arrows of dread.
What's going on? Meg asked. What's that say?
You can't read ancient Greek, I asked.
And you can't tell a strawberry from a yam, she retorted. What's it say?
I gave her the translation. Grover stroked his goatee.
That sounds like Apollo. I mean, you. When you used to be...
good. I swallowed my hurt feelings.
Of course it's Apollo. I mean, me. So, is the maze, like, welcoming you?
Meg asked.
That would have been nice.
I'd always wanted a voice-activated virtual assistant for my palace on Olympus. But Hephaestus hadn't been able to get the technology quite right. The one time he tried, the assistant had been named Alexa Siri Astrophona. She'd been very picky about having her name pronounced perfectly, and at the same time had an annoying habit of getting my requests wrong. I'd say, Alexa Siri Astrophona. Send a plague arrow to destroy Corinth, please. And she would reply, I think you said, men blame rows of soy and corn fleas. Here in the burning maze, I doubted a virtual assistant had been installed. If it had been, it would probably only ask at which temperature I preferred to be cooked. This is a word puzzle, I decided. Like an acrostic or a crossword. The Sybil is trying to guide us to her. Meg frowned at the different hallways.
If she's trying to help, why can't she just make it easy and give us a single direction?
This is how Herophily operates, I said. It's the only way she can help us. I believe we have to, fill in the correct answer in the correct number of spaces. Grover scratched his head. Does anyone have a giant golden pen? I wish Percy were here.
I don't think we need that,
I said. We just need to walk in the right direction to spell out my name. Apollo. 6 letters. Only one of these corridors has 6 spaces.
Are you counting the space we're standing in?
Meg asked.
No, I said. Let's assume this is the start space.
Her question made me doubt myself, though.
What if the answer is Lester?
She said.
That has 6 spaces, too.
The idea made my throat itch.
Will you please stop asking good questions? I had this all figured out.
Or what if the answer is in Greek? Grover added. The question is in Greek. How many spaces would your name be then?
Another annoyingly illogical point.
My name in Greek was Alpha Pi Omicron Lambda Lambda Omega Nu.
That would be 7 spaces, I admitted. Even if transcribed in English, APOLLON.
Ask the arrow of Dodona,
Grover suggested. The scar in my chest tingled like a faulty electric outlet.
That's probably against the rules.
Meg snorted.
You just don't want to talk to the arrow. Why not try?
If I resisted, I imagined she would phrase it as an order. So I pulled forth the arrow of Dodona.
Backeth off, knave!
It buzzed an alarm.
Ne'er again shalt thou stickest me in thy loathsome chest, nor in the eyes of thy enemies.
Relax, I told it. I just want some advice.
So thou sayest now, but I warn thee.
The arrow went deathly still.
But sooth, is this a crossword I see before me? Verily I doth love crosswords.
Oh joy, oh happiness, I turned to my friends. The arrow loves crosswords. I explained our predicament to the arrow, who insisted on getting a closer look at the floor squares and the hint written on the wall. A closer look? With what eyes? I did not know. The arrow hummed thoughtfully.
Methinks the answer shalt beest in the common tongue of English. T'would beest the name by which thou art most familiar in the present day.
He saith, I sighed. He says the answer will be in English. I hope he means modern English and not the strange Shakespearean lingo he speaks.
'Tis not strange,
the arrow objected. Because we don't have enough spaces to spell Apollonius beest thy answereth.
Oh, ha, ha, a jest as weak as thy muscles.
Thanks for playing, I sheathed the arrow. So, friends, the tunnel with six squares. Apollo, shall we?
What if we choose wrong? Grover asked.
Well, I said, perhaps the magic sandals will help? Or perhaps the sandals only allow us to play this game in the first place. And if we stray from the right path, despite the Sybil's efforts to assist us, we will open ourselves up to the fury of the maze.
And we burn to death, Meg said.
I love games, Grover said. Lead on.
The answer is Apollo, I said, just for the record. As soon as I stepped to the next square, a large capital A appeared at my feet. I took this as a good sign. I stepped again, and a P appeared. My two friends followed close behind. At last, we stepped off the sixth square into a small chamber identical to the last. Looking back, the entire word Apollo blazed in our wake. Before us, three more corridors with golden rows of squares led onward, left, right, and forward.
There's another clue, Meg pointed to the wall. Why is this one in English?
I don't know, I said. Then I read aloud the glowing words. Herald of new entrances, opener of the softly gliding year, Janus of the double.
Oh, that guy. Roman god of doorways, Grover shuddered. I met him once.
He looked around suspiciously.
I hope he doesn't pop up. He would love this place.
Meg traced her fingers across the golden lines.
Kinda easy, isn't it? His name's right there in the clue. Five letters. J-A-N-U-S. So it's got to be that way.
She pointed down the hallway on the right, which was the only one with five spaces. I stared at the clue, then the squares. I was beginning to sense something even more unsettling than the heat, but I wasn't sure what it was. Janus isn't the answer, I decided. This is more of a fill-in-the-blanks situation, don't you think? Janus of the double what?
Faces, Grover said. He had two faces, neither of which I need to see again.
I announced aloud to the empty corridor, the correct answer is faces. I received no response, but as we proceeded down the right-hand corridor, the word faces appeared. Reassuringly, we were not roasted alive by Titan fire. In the next chamber, new corridors once again led in three directions. This time, the glowing clue on the wall was again in ancient Greek. A thrill went through me as I read the lines.
I know this. It's from a poem by Bacchylides,
I translated for my friends.
But the highest god, mighty with his thunderbolt, sent Hypnos and his twin from snowy Olympus to the fearless fighter Sarpedon.
Megan Grover stared at me blankly. Honestly, just because I was wearing the Caligula shoes, did I have to do everything? Something is altered in this line, I said. I remember the scene. Sarpedon dies. Zeus has his body carried away from the battlefield. But the wording. Hypnos is the god of sleep, Grover said. That cabin makes excellent milk and cookies, but who's his twin?
My heart ka-thumped.
That's what's different. In the actual line, it doesn't say his twin. It names the twin. Thanatos, or death in English. I looked at the three tunnels. No corridor had 8 squares for Thanatos. One had 10 spaces, one had 4, and one had 5. Just enough to fit death.
Oh no.
I leaned against the nearest wall. I felt like one of aloe vera's spikes was making its slimy way down my back.
Why do you look so scared? Meg asked. You're doing great so far.
Because, Meg, I said, we are not just solving random puzzles. We are putting together a word puzzle prophecy. And so far, it says, Apollo faces death.
Chapter 38. I sing to myself. Though Apollo is cooler. Like, way, way cooler. I hated being right.
When we got to the end of the tunnel, the word death blazed on the floor behind us. We found ourselves in a larger circular chamber. 5 new tunnels branching out before us, like the fingers and thumb of a giant automaton hand. I waited for a new clue to appear on the wall. Whatever it was, I desperately wanted the answer to be, not really, or perhaps, and defeats it easily.
Why is nothing happening?
Grover asked. Meg tilted her head.
Listen.
Blood roared in my ears, but at last I heard what Meg was talking about. A distant cry of pain. Deep and guttural, more beast than human. Along with the dull crackle of fire, as if, oh gods, as if someone or something had been grazed by Titan heat and now lay dying a slow death.
Sounds like a monster, Grover decided. Should we help it?
How? Meg asked. She had a point. The noise echoed. So diffuse I couldn't tell which corridor it came from. Even if we were free to pick our path without answering riddles.
We'll have to keep going, I decided.
I imagine Medea has monsters on guard down here. That must be one of them. I doubt she's too concerned about them occasionally getting caught in the fires. Grover winced.
Doesn't seem right, letting it suffer.
Also, Meg added, what if one of those monsters triggers a flash fire and it comes our way?
I stared at my young master.
You are a fountain of dark questions today. We have to have faith.
In the Sibyl? She asked. In those evil shoes?
I didn't have an answer for her. Fortunately, I was saved by the belated appearance of the next clue. 3 golden lines in Latin.
Oh, Latin, Grover said. Hold on, I can do this.
He squinted at the words, then sighed.
No, I can't.
Honestly? No Greek or Latin, I said. What did they teach you in Seder school?
Mostly, you know, important stuff, like plants.
Thank you, Meg muttered.
I translated the clue for my less educated friends. Now must I tell of the flight of the king, the last to reign over the Roman people, was a man unjust yet puissant in arms. I nodded. I believe that's a quote from Ovid. Neither of my comrades looked impressed.
So, what's the answer? Meg asked.
The last Roman emperor. No, not an emperor, I said. In the very first days of Rome, the city was ruled by kings. The last one, the seventh, was overthrown, and Rome became a republic. I tried to cast my thoughts back to the kingdom of Rome. That whole time period was a little hazy to me. We gods were still based in Greece then. Rome was something of a backwater. The last king, though, he brought back some bad memories. Meg broke my reverie.
What is puissant?
It means powerful, I said.
Doesn't sound like that.
If somebody called me puissant, I would hit them. But you are, in fact, puissant in arms. She hit me.
Ow!
Guys, Grover said, what's the name of the last Roman king?
I thought.
I just had it, and now it's gone. Something.
Taco?
Grover said helpfully.
Why would a Roman king be named Taco?
I don't know. Grover rubbed his stomach. Because I'm hungry?
Curse the satyr. Now all I could think of was tacos.
Then the answer came back to me.
Tarquin, or Tarquinius in the original Latin.
Well, which is it?
Meg asked. I studied the corridors. The tunnel on the far left, the thumb, had 10 spaces, enough for Tarquinius. The tunnel in the middle had 7, enough for Tarquin.
It's that one, I decided, pointing to the center tunnel.
How can you be sure? Grover asked. Because the arrow told us the answers would be in English?
That, I conceded, and also because these tunnels look like 5 fingers.
It makes sense the maze would give me the middle finger. I raised my voice.
Isn't that right? The answer is Tarquin. The middle finger. I love you too, maze.
We walked the path, the name Tarquin blazing in gold behind us. The corridor opened into a square chamber, the largest space we'd seen yet. The walls and floor were tiled in faded Roman mosaics that looked original, though I was fairly sure the Romans had never colonized any part of the Los Angeles metropolitan area. The air felt even warmer and drier. The floor was hot enough that I could feel it through the soles of my sandals. One positive thing about the room, it offered us only 3 new tunnels to choose from, rather than 5. Grover sniffed the air.
I don't like this room. I smell something monstery.
Meg gripped her scimitars.
From which direction?
All of them?
Oh, look, I said, trying to sound cheerful. Another clue. We approached the nearest mosaic wall, where 2 golden lines of English glowed across the tiles. Leaves, body leaves, growing up above me, above death. Perennial roots, tall leaves, oh, the winter shall not freeze you, delicate leaves. Perhaps my brain was still stuck in Latin and Greek, because those lines meant nothing to me, even in plain English.
I like this one, Meg said. It's about leaves.
Yes, lots of leaves, I agreed. But it's nonsense,
Grover choked.
Nonsense! Don't you recognize it?
Should I?
You're the god of poetry.
I felt my face begin to burn.
I used to be the god of poetry, which does not mean I am a walking encyclopedia of every obscure line ever written. Obscure?
Grover's shrill voice echoed unnervingly down the corridors.
That's Walt Whitman, from Leaves of Grass. I don't remember exactly which poem it's from, but...
You read poetry? Meg asked. Grover licked his lips.
You know, mostly nature poetry. Whitman, for a human, had some beautiful things to say about trees.
And leaves, Meg noted. And roots.
Exactly. I wanted to lecture them about how overrated Walt Whitman was. The man was always singing songs to himself instead of praising others, like me, for instance. But I decided the critique would have to wait.
Do you know the answer, then? I asked Grover. Is this a fill-in-the-blanks question, multiple choice, true-false?
Grover studied the lines. I think... Yeah. There's a word missing at the beginning. It's supposed to read tomb leaves, body leaves, etc.
Tomb leaves? Meg asked. That doesn't make sense.
But neither does body leaves, unless he's talking about a dryad.
It's imagery, I said. Clearly he is describing a place of death, overgrown by nature.
Oh, now you're an expert on Walt Whitman, Grover said.
Satyr, don't test me.
When I become a god again...
Both of you stop, Meg ordered.
Apollo, say the answer.
Fine, I sighed.
Maze, the answer is tomb.
We took another successful trip down the middle finger. I mean, central hall. The word tomb blazed in the four squares behind us. At the end, we arrived in a circular room, even larger and more ornate. Across the domed ceiling spread a silver-on-blue mosaic of zodiac signs. Six new tunnels radiated outward. In the middle of the floor stood an old fountain, unfortunately dry. A drink would have been much appreciated. Interpreting poetry and solving puzzles is thirsty work.
The rooms are getting bigger, Grover noted, and more elaborate.
Maybe that's good, I said. It might mean we're getting closer. Meg eyed the zodiac images.
You sure we didn't take a wrong turn? The prophecy doesn't even make sense so far. Apollo faces death, Tarquin tomb?
You have to assume the small words, I said. I believe the message is, Apollo faces death in Tarquin's tomb. I gulped.
Actually, I don't like that message. Perhaps the little words we're missing are, Apollo faces no death. Tarquin's tomb. Something, something.
Maybe the next words are, grants him fabulous prizes.
Uh-huh.
Meg pointed at the rim of the central fountain, where the next clue had appeared. Three lines in English read, Named for Apollo's fallen love, this flower should be planted in autumn. Set the bulb in the soil with the pointy end up. Cover with soil and water thoroughly. You are transplanting. I stifled a sob. First the maze forced me to read Walt Whitman. Now it taunted me with my own past. To mention my dead love, Hyacinthus, and his tragic death. To reduce him to a bit of oracle trivia. No, this was too much. I sat down on the rim of the fountain and cupped my face in my hands.
What's wrong?
Grover asked nervously. Meg answered.
Those lines are talking about his old boyfriend.